morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. With the election of Donald Trump as the next president of the United States, how do we go forward to protect the Pacific Northwest from the ravages of fossil fuel development? This morning we talk with Dan Sears, Columbia Riverkeeper Conservation Director, about the status of current campaigns to ban fossil fuel infrastructure development in the Portland-Vancouver region. We'll look at the power we maintain as a region to hold the line on local fossil fuel development and the Northwest's fortuitous position to block the export of much of the nation's fossil fuels. Dan, welcome back to Locus Focus.
It's great to be here.
It's good to have you back. And so I open up with these rather optimistic remarks we were both discussing before we came on the air about how we are having trouble sleeping lately. So what my goal for this show is today is to help my listeners sleep at night by thinking about all the things that we can do that will block the worst ravages of a Trump administration. So let's start with what's going on in the Portland City Council right now. Last time I saw you was right after Election Day, and there were hearings, the kind of the final stages of hearings to put into place an actual ordinance that bans most fossil fuel storage development in Portland. So let's talk a little bit about what's going on there.
Yeah, I think what happened in Portland at the city council in this case was a really pleasant surprise. And it was a result of citizen pressure. Despite everyone being pretty depressed about what had happened the day before, we had a packed house for a really important hearing where the city council considered testimony from hundreds of people had showed up. And there were, a week later, they held a second hearing, and again, a packed house. And what they heard was emphatic testimony from people all over the city asking the city council to really stop Portland from expanding fossil fuel infrastructure in any way.
Now, back about a year ago, the city passed this momentous, revolutionary ban, or it was actually a plan to make a ban to create this ordinance. And it was celebrated everywhere as like a real groundbreaking move to really pull back on fossil fuel development and really hold as what Eric DePlace from Sightline calls the thin green line. But then there was some dismay about what was happening as it was actually being implemented. So what was the discord between what was done a year ago and what the initial proposed ordinance was?
Yeah, the initial proposal we saw back in July was much, much weaker than either the really emphatic resolution that passed a year ago or even the initial committee meetings that had been discussing what it could look like. And so that was really disappointing. What we saw was a huge exemption to allow existing facilities to grow. Another that would have allowed new facilities up to 5 million gallons to be built. A potential carve out for Northwest Natural Gas, which was seeking an exemption of its entire utility, all that fracked gas. And that was really surprising. And so really in the last couple months, hundreds and thousands of people have weighed in with the city council and have really rescued this policy and brought it back to that landmark resolution and the intent of that resolution that was passed a year ago. And in so doing, essentially the city of Portland is signaling now that the fossil fuel industry will not grow in the city of Portland. Portland serves as a hub for particularly transportation fuels throughout the region and will, for the foreseeable future, probably continue to do that. But it will do so with the infrastructure we have now. And to the extent that we can upgrade it for seismic reasons, we are trying to get that done through other means, not through allowing expansion of fossil fuel infrastructure. And that was a central debate in this whole process, was whether more fossil fuel infrastructure is a way to make you safer from earthquakes. And that was something that luckily the city council didn't buy in the end, and certainly the public did not.
There were two bits of testimony that really struck me at the hearing that was 2 days after Election Day. And one was a lot of students, many of them from Sunnyside Environmental School, who gave really passionate and tearful testimony, particularly in the light of what had just happened 2 days earlier, saying that there was no reason on earth, basically, for the city to allow, it was supposed to be a 10% increase in size for any fossil fuel facilities that were going to do seismic upgrades as a way to encourage them to do seismic upgrades. And I watched the city council people responding to this really emotional testimony. It was also not just emotional, but made total sense. And having such logic, clear logic coming out of the mouths of people who were like between the ages of 12 and 16 was pretty poignant. The other piece that I found equally interesting was a representative from Kinder Morgan, who has storage facilities along St. Helens Road. And he started out by saying that he felt like he'd come to a barbecue and he was the meat, which was an interesting thing. And I wasn't sure who this guy was until he started talking. And then he was basically saying that 10% increase wasn't enough to justify the cost of doing seismic upgrades. They have to do at least 30, 40, 50% increases. At which point I was watching everybody on city council and these little light bulbs were going on. Well, then let's keep it to zero. So let's talk a little bit about those two kind of conflicting bits of testimony and how that shaped the debate.
Yeah, the Kinder Morgan piece is kind of where things turned in a way, because they, the tone was very combative with the city council. And it was, you know, I think the city council was sitting there looking at a room with a sea of red shirts, hundreds of people there. Yeah.
And what does it mean? What does red shirts mean for those people who haven't been to these hearings?
You know, I don't know who gets the credit for the red shirt. It started with the LNG fight years and years ago. That was the first time I saw it. It's generally a signal that we are opposed to fossil fuel infrastructure.
And the proponents wear blue shirts, right?
It's been a variety of colors for proponents. Sometimes you see green, and for the methanol terminal in Kalama, it's been green. In this case, it was really, I think, very counterproductive for Kinder Morgan to push so aggressively for really a free hand to expand however they want. And, you know, Kinder Morgan has a really checkered history, obviously, throughout the Northwest. They were a proponent for a while of a 30 million ton coal facility that would have brought many coal trains through Portland and through Columbia County. They've been pushing hard, obviously, for the Trans Mountain pipeline further north along the Washington-Canadian border. And, you know, they didn't get this one. The city council, I think, looked at the room and said, well, we can do what this one person wants, this one entity, or we can do what everyone else seems to be asking. And they did that. So where we stand right now is, because of the three votes of Commissioner Novick, Commissioner Fritz, and Mayor Hales, we have an ordinance that's ready for a vote on December 8th. We're hoping for a 5-0 vote. And we think the votes are there to make it pass. It would be an emphatic statement for it to be unanimous from the city council.
So should people be at the hearing on December 8th?
Yes, on December 8th at 2 p.m., that's the tentative time, and it should go fairly quickly. I think they're basically just voting. They may have statements at that time. We encourage people to be there. There are some other important issues on the agenda for City Council that day, including, I believe, inclusionary zoning may be happening around the same time, another very important issue for many people.
Which just kind of makes my mind leap. I had one of my epiphanies in the last few weeks was thinking about how we have all these different issues we work on. And my partner was saying right after the election, we really have to just come together and figure out a way that everybody's working together. And then as Trump has been nominating different people to different posts in his cabinet and in the government, and each one is an attack on each one of the different groups that has been working so hard over the last decades for really good social, environmental justice and important change. And so it's looking at, I think that the Trump administration is showing us how we all belong together, how we really are all united, because we're all under attack together. And there's no way that we can just like focus on one thing now. So I think that that's another thing that maybe we're seeing at City Council. I find it interesting that we would go from the vote on banning fossil fuel infrastructure in the city to talking about inclusionary zoning, which are two equally important and maybe very related topics.
Yeah, and it's a reason why I think people in Portland have still a lot of work to do. You know, we might feel like we're isolated, Oregon went blue, but we have the ability as a city here, and indeed as an entire state and region, to set an example and to really influence the way communities can grow, or communities can be healthy and safe for people, and communities can work for a stable climate. All of these things are, this has been called the laboratory. Cities are the laboratories for states. A state can be the laboratory for the nation. We have to really, really work hard to do that while defending the most vulnerable people among us.
Well, I've done a few programs about the important role that cities play in first of all, staving off the worst excesses of climate change. But you're describing cities as kind of the laboratories. now that we are probably going to have a federal government that is a total antithesis to everything that we have been working for here, what role or how does that enhance or intensify the role that Portland and Oregon and the Pacific Northwest as a region play in continuing the struggles that we've been doing?
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, a lot of this began and people have been fighting some version of the fossil fuel industry for many decades. It didn't begin with LNG, but for the last 12 years or so, people in Coos Bay and on the Columbia River have been fighting LNG. And that really started as a states' rights versus federal overreach issue. It's why we had such a broad coalition, is that the federal government took siting control from the state. And the federal government said, we will put, you know, up to 5 LNG terminals in Oregon. That's how many were proposed initially. And Oregonians organized. They fought back. They funded lawsuits. They funded organizing, media campaigns, and held their ground and are still holding their ground in Southern Oregon. And so in many cases, we are not relying on the federal government for decisions that are going to lead us to victory. We're relying on communities to continue to stand firm and to persuade more local leaders, whether they're city, county, or state officials, to make those decisions. And you can tick through the various fossil fuel monstrosities that are proposed right now. The Northwest is still really, really under the gun. We have the largest, you know, in a span of maybe 30 miles in the Columbia River, we have the largest oil terminal in the world, or oil by rail terminal in North America, I should say, at Vancouver. The largest methanol terminal in the world proposed to Kalama, and the largest coal terminal now proposed in North America in Longview. And that's just in that short stretch. But for each of those, we are really looking at local and state officials to make the important decisions to protect. It would be fantastic if the Federal Army Corps of Engineers did something like it did for the Lummi and honored their treaty rights.
And remind people where that is.
Yeah, it was in Washington State, where an even larger coal terminal was proposed. It's a sacred place for the Lummi Nation, and they emphatically opposed it. They said it was a treaty right issue for them, and the Corps agreed. I mean, it wasn't really a judgment call. It was very obviously a violation of the treaty, and it was still surprising in some ways that the Corps managed to see their way to honor that and to really cancel that project, the Gateway Pacific Terminal. So we've had a string of successes in the Northwest, and that one really is a success for the Lummi Nation, who, and their success really benefited the entire region. So we're down to the last coal terminal now in Longview, and some of that decision making falls to the Corps, but a lot of it falls to the state. And those state decision makers include Governor Inslee and a new state lands commissioner in Washington, Hillary Franz. Not sure I'm even saying her last name correctly. It might be Franz. But she is going to be a very important decision maker for that project as well, and is already getting pressure from industry groups to reverse her position and support and rather than oppose the coal terminal in Longview.
So she's gone on record so far as opposing the coal terminal?
She did. She ran very clearly as a candidate opposing both oil and coal terminals and won handily in a contested race. And I think that's a real, real statement about where Washington is at. Despite that, you know, Washington has just enormous proposals. The methanol terminal in Kalama would be the largest of its kind in the world. The untold story so far about the methanol terminal is that would also likely require new pipelines to be built to supply it, not just the 3-mile pipeline, which is doing potentially a lot of damage or would do a lot of damage if built, but the pipelines that would feed that 3-mile spur up and down the I-5 corridor and potentially a new version of the Palomar pipeline, which people who've worked with the LNG Coalition or with BARC will remember very well, the pipeline over the Mount Hood Forest that we defeated.
That was the one that was going to go to Astoria.
It was going to go to the Bradwood LNG terminal. That's right. And this would be kind of a version of that called Trail West. And Northwest Natural has included that as one option in their integrated resource plan, which is their kind of picture of the future. Northwest Natural is also trying to work with the methanol developer to loan its supply, in effect, for a couple years until that methanol terminal is up and running, until a new pipeline is up and running. And so we know we have major, major struggles ahead of us to keep holding the thin green line. how we do that is going to really require the engagement. It's going to require that exhaustion you were talking about earlier, where we want people to be so tired of, you know, being engaged and empowered activists that they can sleep at night, even though Donald Trump is president.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Dan Sears, who is a frequent guest here on Locus Focus. He's the conservation director with Columbia Riverkeeper, and we're talking about how to hold the thin green line against fossil fuel development here in the Pacific Northwest, in spite of the fact that Donald Trump will most likely become president. We can still hold out a few scenarios of how that might not happen, but they're probably pretty remote. Before we go back to the methanol terminal, which I think we should spend a lot of time talking about for the rest of the show, I just wanted to, again, help people sleep by remembering all the achievements that have been made to protect the Northwest for the resources that we've always valued and to protect it from the exploitation by fossil fuel industries to turn it into this major export hub. We kind of lightly talked about some of the big projects that are still alive, but I wanted to just kind of run down all the projects that have been shut down and mm-hmm. kind of like a little note on each one about why each one was killed.
Yeah, there's a great activist in Vancouver, Don Steinke, who many people know, who has this list that just keeps growing and growing. And every once in a while, he'll use his testimony time to just run through all the terminals that have been defeated. And that's people, you know, that's activism that's done it. It's been, I mean, this year alone, you know, we start with, we came off the Pembina victory last year and rolled into this process with the city of Portland.
Remind people what Pembina was.
Pembina was a huge propane terminal proposed in Portland that initially had support. At least maybe support from Mayor Hales. And when he reversed course, he really did it emphatically and even pushed this fossil fuel policy, which is a real beacon for other cities to follow. So that was one of the first to fall. Just in the past few weeks, you've seen the end of the coal export terminal, finally. That was proposed to barge coal from Boardman to Port Westward. A huge victory for the people in the Lower Columbia River with the end of LNG on the Columbia River, finally. We saw the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission deny the Jordan Cove and Pacific Connector pipeline project, which
that
is
that one still lives, though, right?
It's in an undead
it's zombie stage.
Yeah, sort of a zombie stage. It really is dead until someone revives it, and FERC could revive it by reversing their decision. And that's something that people are guarding against. But right now, other federal agencies have stopped work on it because there's nothing there.
Now, what kind of impact will a Trump presidency have on FERC? How soon before they be new FERC commissioners?
Very soon, as soon as they're confirmed by Republican Senate. And so you're looking at seeing a Federal Energy Regulatory Commission that starts behaving much more like it always has. It's hard to overstate how much of an outlier the Jordan Cove denial was. While it was a completely reasonable and correct decision to deny that project, it's the only one we've seen like it in recent history, where they denied a major LNG and pipeline project.
And this is a FERC that has like gone through both Republican and Democratic administrations, including 7 years of Obama.
That's right. And to be honest, you know, when it came to the Columbia River, we never thought that FERC was a path to victory for us, and so we were shocked when FERC. Even though the people in Southern Oregon had made an overwhelmingly compelling case for why it was an incredibly stupid project. Landowners banded together and they just refused to budge and would not give access to their property, would not give permission. And all of that remains. All of that is in place. And just whatever FERC does, the state of Oregon can decide to turn that project down. And most of the major decisions for the state of Oregon have been on hold pending whatever FERC decides to do in either reversing its denial or continuing with it. So the Jordan Cove project is one that we'll have to watch very closely that has probably the most significant federal interplay. The others, particularly these in more locally, the Longview project really faces enormous opposition throughout the region, and the decisions will fall to, you know, an agency, the Department of Ecology and Governor Inslee. And the new lands commissioner, Hillary Fons, who has to decide whether this is a good use of state land in Washington to let it be used for a 44 million ton per year coal facility. That's 16 coal trains, 8 full, 8 empty every day. The oil issue has been amazing to watch, you know, sort of the cresting of most of the projects. You know, we saw Shell pull out of a proposed facility, you know, at an existing terminal due to citizen opposition. You know, they cited market reasons, but it was very clear that they were facing enormous opposition after the Shell No effort and people throughout the region visiting Shell and Anacortes, and obviously visiting the Fenica as it came through here in Portland. They pulled the plug.
So this is up in Anacortes?
Yeah. And
this was going to be a large refiner.
It was going to be another oil by rail facility to bring in more oil trains and to ship that oil all over the place. What we saw happen in Mosier was a big wake-up call, you know, and I guess the way Rob Davis, the Oregonian, said, we didn't really need a wake-up call. We were pretty darn awake to how dangerous these trains were. We got one anyway. And instead of being powerless and falling silent, the people in the gorge have been tireless advocates for an end to oil trains, to see the oil trains we're seeing now be the last ones, the last trains that are this volatile, this dangerous, going up and down the Columbia River Gorge. And this was a moment, too, where the real leaders were the Columbia River tribes, who within days of that derailment, fire and spill, where oil is leaching through the groundwater, spilling into the Columbia River, causing a sheen where sockeye salmon were supposed to be passing through just 2 weeks later. They held an event in Mosier, a healing ceremony, and you know, heads of tribes from all over the Northwest came, from the Lummi, from Warm Springs in Yakima and Umatilla. It was really an amazing showing of unity, and their call was very blunt, very direct, and it said, you know, we don't think it's appropriate to put coal or oil trains through these places and most of the really sensitive fishing sites that are used by these tribal members are wedged between the oil train tracks, the proposed oil train tracks, and the river itself. They are really, really on the front line of what would happen. And so their voice, I think, carried very strongly and emboldened the elected leaders from Mosier, including Mosier's Mayor Arlene Burns, who was here in Portland testifying to Mayor Hales just a couple weeks ago. And she has been a real leader, but not alone. Hood River, even the Dalles, recently, thanks to incredible work from people all over the region, Wasco County turned down an expansion of the rail infrastructure. Wasco County's about as conservative as they come.
And voted for Trump, Arlene reminded me, actually.
Yeah, that's right.
And Mosier actually is in Wasco County.
But that's
it's
right.
A little, it's kind of like the Austin of Wasco County.
Small enough to make a difference, as they say, yeah, in Mosier. And so rather than that being kind of a moment where everyone threw up their hands and said, well, there's nothing we can do about these oil trains. They're reckless, but we can't stop them. We've seen thousands of people turning out to hearings. And if I were betting, I would say the Tesoro Terminal in Vancouver is dead. It's dead on its feet.
Now, you've said that to me a few times. Actually, I remember we were at City Hall one time for a press conference about Mosier, and you were ready to say you thought it was going to be that the Port Commission was going to pull the plug. So
yeah.
Now you're saying this again. I mean, what are your grounds for saying that?
I just think it would be insane for any elected official to approve a terminal that would bring five more loaded trains a day down the Columbia River Gorge like the one that derailed in Mosier. I think, you know, and the decision maker in the end is the newly reelected Governor Inslee. He would have to look at what happened in Mosier and say, yeah, I'll take five more of those a day.
Well, he actually came out very strongly against oil trains after Mosier, as I recall.
He did.
He made a much stronger statement, I think, than Kate Brown made.
Yeah, well, it was funny. She actually beat him to the punch. She was stronger first, and then he kind of came around. He has to be really careful because he's the judge. At the end of this whole multi-year process of reviewing this oil terminal, he has to make a very simple but very important decision about whether or not the oil terminal goes forward. And just for folks to remember, Vancouver would be the site of an oil-by-rail terminal that would accept 360,000 barrels of oil a day. That's almost half the size of the Keystone XL pipeline, about 44% of Keystone XL. Just an enormous amount of oil, up to five loaded trains a day, each over a mile in length, plowing through downtown Mosier, in quotes, doing air quotes here on the radio.
It's two blocks long.
But yeah, exactly. But through downtown Spokane, through downtown Vancouver. Vancouver put out a report estimating that a worst-case derailment there could cost the city $5 billion and many lives, potentially. And so we've seen this sort of sea change in the outlook for Tesoro. Despite that, Tesoro continues to push the project. They are seeking a relatively minor permit right now from the Energy Facilities Site Evaluation Council in Washington. There'll be a hearing tomorrow. In fact, if people are listening and are looking for a way to weigh in, it's a construction stormwater discharge permit. It's required under the Clean Water Act. The hearing begins at 2 p.m. at Geyser Hall. It's 1933 Fort Vancouver Way. It will probably not have the huge throngs that we've seen in other oil train hearings, but it's an important opportunity to let this council know that they should take every opportunity to turn this project down. And in fact, you know, even the relatively minor issues like stormwater are a really big issue when you have to build such enormous infrastructure to handle this amount of oil and dig so deeply into this area of liquefiable soil in the Columbia River. It's going to create a lot of stormwater. It's actually a big deal, but it's not the big decision. The big decision is coming in 2017 when Governor Inslee and this council are going to give a thumbs up or a thumbs down to the entire project. And so we're keeping our eyes on the prize and realizing that we have in 2017 this window of time where we'll see potentially a final decision on the coal terminal in Longview, potentially a final decision on the oil terminal in Vancouver, and maybe a thumbs up or a thumbs down finally to what's currently a dead Jordan Cove Pacific Connector project. And then wedged in the middle of all of that is the world's largest methanol terminal, which is...
And we're going to get to that in a moment.
Yeah.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Dan Sears, who's the Columbia River Keeper Conservation Director, and we're talking about ways to continue the struggle to keep the Pacific Northwest relatively fossil fuel free, or at least to not expand our fossil fuel development at this point. Before we talk about the methanol refinery, which I think is a lot of where our focus needs to be in the coming months, I just wanted to kind of expand our localism here and kind of move down the Pacific coast. I was just transcribing an interview that I did last summer with Andre Sota, who's with the Communities for Better Environment in Richmond, and he's been a big opponent and leading voice in fighting the Chevron refinery, which completely dominates the Richmond landscape. And he was describing the oil trains. Well, he's talking about how in Rodeo, which is just a little bit north of Richmond, they are already bringing in tar sands oil by boat. It comes into the San Francisco Bay. And then they're going to put it on trains. They also, and the big debate is about whether the Chevron refinery in Richmond would also be, quote, modernized so that it could handle the heavy oil. And I think they did a bargain, which he wasn't very happy with. So I was unclear about whether they're really going to be able to refine tar sands oil in Richmond, but they're definitely doing it already in Rodeo. So he's describing this train of full of oil that's going to be going on many, many train loads and going all the way down the coast through all these communities, kind of what you were describing, the trains going through the Northwest, and then going over this incredible, challenging mountain pass to go down to San Luis Obispo, where Phillips 66 is trying to build a refinery. And I had this image of mayors fighting this struggle. My old friend Jan Marks is, until the end of the year, has been the mayor of San Luis Obispo for 6 years. And she was, there was a conference then in San Luis this summer, and Arlene Burns was there. And I hooked them up by email. Arlene sent me a photo of the two of them with their arms around each other. And it was just like mayors in solidarity. And then I saw another picture recently of Arlene arms around Charlie Hales. Actually, that's on your website. And I just think about these mayors that are taking these struggles really to the forefront. And so do you see this as a sign of the future as we are dealing with a federal administration probably much less sympathetic to our concerns even than the Obama administration? Do you see that this alliance of mayors is going to play a really important role in holding the thin green line?
I hope so. And I know that Mayor Wheeler has indicated he is really interested.
And Mayor Wheeler is the mayor of what?
He will be the mayor of Portland.
Mayor Wheeler.
Yeah,
oh,
Wheeler.
Okay.
Yeah, soon to be mayor. Hopefully we'll continue some of the good work that Mayor Hales has accomplished here at the end and set his own course and keep Portland pushing and dealing with these issues and working with these other cities. I know the city of Eugene is going to be approached by, I know the local 350 group is trying to get them to make a resolution against oil trains. Los Angeles right now is considering, is very important in this whole picture, it turns out. The Tesoro project in Vancouver is directly connected to the refinery in Los Angeles, whatever wouldn't be exported overseas and whatever doesn't blow up in the Columbia River Gorge, presumably would go to one of Tesoro's refineries, the largest of which is, or one of the largest is in LA, and it's being retrofitted right now, or there's a proposal, I'm sorry, to retrofit it. And so there's a direct connection between the Vancouver proposal and the Los Angeles refinery, and Tesoro's trying to pretend as if there's no connection. They're telling their investors, look how great this is, we're integrating our supply line, and you know we're going to be getting our own oil from our Vancouver terminal. And they're telling all the environmental reviewers, there's no connection between these two things. Don't look over here, don't look over there. Consider them completely separately. And so Communities for a Better Environment in Los Angeles have reached out and are asking people throughout the region to weigh in with Los Angeles decision makers and help in that effort. You know, the same goes for little towns. I mean, some of the oil resolutions are actually based on, the first one was in Hoquiam, a little coastal town in Washington, where great folks like Tammy and Arnie, these awesome activists working in a really rural community, place that went through the timber wars and still has politics to reflect that, where after seeing a barrage of proposals to bring in oil terminals, passed a resolution to not allow more. And that was the template that Vancouver used to actually pass binding rules that wouldn't allow any future major oil terminal in the city. And the Westway Terminal in Grace Harbor is among the oil terminals, one of the ones that it's going to be a decision from the Department of Ecology. And the local jurisdiction, City of Hoquiam, and they have a really, really important decision to make about whether or not they're going to allow a very large oil terminal, and that means more oil trains through the Portland metro area, through Vancouver. Some of these projects are really in play right now, and it's going to be cities, counties, and states that make the decisions that matter for the people in the Northwest, as much as we are disturbed by where the federal decision making will probably be going. We're going to have to use the tools that are left to us even more effectively.
Now, what about the mayor of Vancouver, Washington?
Mayor Leavitt was pretty vocal about the coal export issue and helped the city of Vancouver pass a resolution pretty early on, actually, in opposition to coal export, or at least in supporting a very strong, full analysis of the Longview and Bellingham area coal proposals. Less of a leader on oil, and but has voted, he voted with the majority in a unanimous vote to prohibit the city from considering even any future new oil terminal. So he's come around on oil. But I mean, the amazing leaders in Vancouver have been some of the other city council members who've taken this up. You know, Bart Hansen is a city council. He's been up in Mosier, you know, traveled up there to stand in solidarity with Arlene Burns, the mayor of Mosier. Councilmember Topper and Councilmember McErnie Ogle, they've been vocal and they've helped sculpt and lead the city towards passing not just a resolution, but again, binding rules that will prevent it from becoming a big oil terminal once the Vancouver Energy Project from Tesoro is off the table.
Well, in the remaining moments, let's go back to the methanol refinery, yeah, which you keep alluding to. First of all, what is methanol, and what would the methanol that be refined in this refinery be used for? Where would it go?
Yeah, it's methane to methanol. And so the gas would come from, a lot of it would come from fracking. It's a lot like liquefied natural gas in this way. It's an enormous amount of fracked methane gas that would be coming into the Northwest and turned into a liquid form for export to Asia. And the investor in this project is called Northwest Innovation Works. They're a project of the Chinese Academy of Sciences. So it's directly the Chinese government investing in a project in Calhoun County, which is interesting on a lot of levels. You know, the methanol supply, the methane supply is one of the reasons why so many people are concerned about the project. But the idea of dredging this big hole in the Columbia River and shipping it overseas, it looks a lot like liquefied natural gas export. And the impacts on the Columbia River are really significant. So people in Klamath have been organizing. It's a small town, but people have been running petitions, going to their city council, going to the port, trying to get the port in particular to reconsider. Again, this is an issue that started local, but it's of statewide significance. It's an enormous amount of natural gas. It's over 300, or it's up to 320 million cubic feet of natural gas that would be used to supply this methane to methanol terminal. In doing that, they're really going to have to build new pipelines somewhere. And they haven't tipped their hand yet on exactly which projects are the ones they intend to use to supply this terminal. That is the classic bait and switch. It's the same thing the LNG developers tried to do when they first came into the Northwest. They tried to hide the Palomar pipeline from everyone. And that's almost exactly what they're doing with the methane to methanol refinery. It's really a refinery in Kalama. It would be an enormous power user. It'd be an enormous methane user. And it would require big pipelines. And once those pipelines are built, they could be used to facilitate other gas development, things like new gas-fired power plants. And so for people keeping an eye on the fracked gas world, the Northwest is poised to dramatically expand its consumption of methane, a very potent greenhouse gas, on par with coal when you take the whole life cycle impact of the methane leakage that comes with natural gas production.
So despite what Hillary Clinton said, this is not a bridge fuel to the future.
That's right. And someone needs to tell PGE that as well, because Portland General Electric is looking at a very large build-out of Boardman in natural gas. They would, in the end, if they got all of their wishes, build twice as much natural gas-fired power at Boardman than they had in coal, which you're losing ground there in Boardman if that happens that way. And so PGE is another major target in this regional campaign to hold the thin green line. We don't want to be a hub for fracked gas any more than we want to be a hub for coal or oil or any of this other dirty energy.
Now, where's this fracked gas coming from?
It would come some of it from Canada, and some of it depends on where the pipelines come from. It could come from the Mountain West. So
I know there's a lot of fracked gas in eastern British Columbia.
Yes.
And I think some in Alberta. Actually, I know there's some in Alberta.
Yeah, and there's a lot in Colorado and Wyoming. In fact, the governor of Colorado has been vocal about wanting to see liquefied natural gas export terminals in Oregon established. The methane to methanol refinery is it's something that everyone should watch and be engaged. There's a new, if you want the lowdown on this terminal, this refinery, take a look at ColumbiaRiverKeeper.org. There's a short video we just posted there last week. It gives you a synopsis of the issue, and you hear from a couple of the voices of people who have been really active in the fight against this. But we need to shoehorn this issue out of Cowlitz County and make it a regional issue, because it's going to impact everyone in the region if we start having to build new pipelines to supply this huge methanol export operation.
Well, we'll keep checking in on that and probably have you back on in a couple months to give us an update.
Yeah, and we've worked with Jasmine Zimmerstucki has been really leading that campaign.
Right. We had her on a few months ago. Right.
She lives in Kalama almost these days. So.
Well, one last thing I wanted to talk about, which is very hard not to talk about today, is Standing Rock. And I just wanted to kind of get your feelings about the decision that the Army Corps of Engineers handed down right after Thanksgiving and what people can do to support Standing Rock.
Well, there's a rally at 2 p.m. today, and you have the details on that.
I'll read that after you finish, just giving me your response.
You know, what's really important is that we don't see this as an either-or issue. In fighting oil trains, you know, we've seen tribal nations here actively engaged in the fight against oil trains. We've also seen those tribal nations standing in solidarity with the incredible work of the people in Standing Rock. So it's super, super important for people to keep engaged with this. What the Corps did this week was say on federal land, no less, that the people out there legally, peacefully protesting must move. Energy Transfer Partners is desperate to get this pipeline built. They need to get it built for their investors. They bet on the Army Corps rubber stamping this project and doing exactly what they've done so far, which is taking each piece on it separately. It's piecemealing an enormous project that should have had one comprehensive environmental review. If they had done that, maybe they would have realized that there was a real problem with putting a huge oil pipeline through the water supply for all of these people. This is another one of those linchpin places. It's just incredible to watch how peaceful protests, nonviolent action in this way, and prayerful water protectors have stood their ground for so long that Energy Transfer Partners is becoming more and more desperate, and it's really disturbing to see the Army Corps move in lockstep with Energy Transfer and start to dislodge or attempt to dislodge these folks. My brother just came from Standing Rock. He's a reporter, and he was there, and he told me those folks aren't going anywhere, no matter what the Corps says. He left and said, I don't know what's going to happen, but those folks are not leaving by December 5th.
Well, if you want to step in and lend your support today, there's going to be a national 24-hour rally in front of all offices of the Army Corps of Engineers. It begins at 2 p.m. local time and will stay last for 24 hours. People are invited to stay as long as you like. You can bring sleeping bags and tents and spend the night. I know one person who, she said, she's so mad, she's thinking about spending the night. So if you're mad, it's a good thing to do. We have two offices here where you can protest. One is the Northwest Regional District. It's 1201 Northeast Lloyd Boulevard, number 400. And I imagine the protest is going to be on the corner of 12th and Lloyd Boulevard, outside the building. And then the Portland District office is at 333 Southwest 1st Avenue, where the protest was 2 weeks ago that moved into Waterfront Park. This is a nationwide show of support for water protectors at OCD's Sakowin in Standing Rock, North Dakota, in response to the order to vacate by December 5th. Army Corps land that is currently occupied by water protectors encamped at OCD Sakowin. So this is one way to support Standing Rock, and other ways are also, I think, if I don't have the website here, but if you just go to either the Standing Rock Facebook page or just Google Standing Rock, I'm sure you can get to a place where you can help give money or whatever kind of support they need. And I know people that are planning on going out soon. So, Dan, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. And we covered a lot of ground. I know it's a troubling time, but we are in a place where we have a disproportionate amount of influence on how some of the biggest energy decisions are going to be made.
And let's do it. So thanks for being with us. We've been talking with Dan Sears this morning. He's the Columbia Riverkeeper Conservation Director, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on Kibu Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, Eric DePlace with Sightline Institute returns to Locus Focus to share his perspectives on how the world has changed since election night and what we can do in the Northwest to stay the course toward a carbon-free future. My engineer is Jenka Sodenberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music with Standing Rock by Jim Pepper. Thanks for listening. Pio te ho wenda, ya na wana ho, pio te ho wenda, ya na wana ho, pio te ho wenda, ya na wana ho, ya na ne, e ne nui. Wichi tanto, gime wa, huaniko hurane, ya na ne no. Wichi tanto, gime wa, huaniko hurane, ya na e ne nui. Wichi tanto gime wa waniko rane yana ne no. Wichi tanto gime wa waniko rane, waniko rane, waniko rane.